Hey everybody, I'm Ben from the band Dive, and I'm here with the rest of the band Dive. Fellas.
Hey, it's Cole from Dive.
Hi, I'm Andrew Bailey.
This is Colin.
And here we are, a mere 3 years after the last episode of the podcast. Pretty funny to just like do a podcast after not doing it for 3 years.
Feels good to be back.
Yeah. When I was looking at that date of the last published episode, I was like, huh. And I feel like this, it coincides with us like earnestly starting to do demos for the new record is like about when we stopped doing the podcast. Yeah. And wow.
That just feels right.
Yeah. And now the record is done. And so here we are making a podcast.
I think at the time we weren't, I feel like we've gotten a lot better at multitasking now.
Hopefully.
I mean, already I feel like in preparing for the music to come out, it feels like we're on top of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of like mostly why we stopped, I guess. But also like we were driving ourselves a little crazy with the podcast. We were like, all the episodes were like super duper researched.
We'd spend like a week like reading about the band and listening to all their stuff and trying to like, you know, the podcast originally were like, let's talk about a record we like. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden we're covering Sonic Youth's entire discography.
Yeah.
And like, just too much, it was too much work. And like, it felt like nobody cared. And then we'll go on tour and people are like, you know, in between songs, people are like, played Doused or whatever, but they were saying like the they're saying the Dive podcast.
Oh, your flashlight's
Hello?
On.
Yeah. No, we're recording the Dive podcast right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how you do like a project, and if you don't have immediate returns, you yeah. think that it's like a failure. But then you look at so many different podcasts and shows and a lot of stuff that gets made for the internet for a long time, like no one cares. And then all of a sudden, like a YouTube channel will have like 400,000 followers or something.
I think especially podcasts too. People do tons of episodes before anybody really starts listening, which is frustrating. But we kind of like didn't, we only did 9 episodes total.
Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Uh-huh.
Man. Well, we did 10. Do y'all remember what actually killed
the
podcast?
Oh yeah.
What
the
was
Wu-Tang
it?
The
Wu-Tang
episode.
Wu-Tang episode killed us.
Yeah, because I just went way too hard researching it. Like, I was like, okay, now's my chance to, like, explain to the world what Wu-Tang Clan is. And we recorded, like, 3 hours or something, and it was only half done.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we just said, let's forget this. Which sucks, because it was a good episode, I think, even though it was 90% me talking.
Yeah, I used that episode, the audio, to make deepfakes of all our voices.
Yeah.
So at least we got something out of it.
Yeah, maybe that'll be a B-side someday.
It felt like the Sonic Youth one was still the one that broke us, though, because we successfully finished that one, but it was such an enormous amount of work that it like raised the bar.
Yeah.
And then I think probably the Wu-Tang episode in your mind, Bailey, since you were like leading that episode, you were like, I have to come with like, you know, an entire web pages amount of information or something.
And I think I was also overly concerned with how well it was edited. Cause I would spend like for every minute that we recorded, I would spend 5 minutes editing.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just a nightmare.
And now we got another podcast editor in
yeah.
the house.
Ben's I'm a pro been, editor.
Ben's been editing the culture journalist.
Yeah. I do wonder if there's any tips I could get from you.
Oh, yeah, I got you. I've been helping my friend. Well, not really helping. She knows what she's doing, but offering pointers to the podcast Sad Girls Against the Patriarchy, which I recommend. And it's bringing back so many things that I just forgot were my entire life for like those months.
Yeah.
What we have to do is just edit while we're talking. So as soon as I finish talking, you just talk.
Fuck. But even, yeah, just like why we're doing it again now was, as we just said, it's been 3 years and we only had 9 episodes. And I feel like even as recently as like a week ago, someone brought it up of like, man, I love the podcast. It's like, we did get really lucky or something where people like really fuck with it. So I feel like that's the main reason why we're bringing it back, in addition to it being fun and us liking doing it, is like so many people have asked for it. So
here you are, here we are, piggies.
There have been plenty of points in the last 3 years where we've had a conversation and then afterwards someone's like, that should have been a podcast episode. Yeah.
That happened earlier today.
Yeah. So it's just good to know that like it doesn't have to have this like rigid format or anything. Mm-hmm. We can just be talking.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say also, was like, it's not probably going to be the same as it used to be. We might do some episodes like that, but like we're easing into it and just going to like this one will be chill, and who knows what the next episode will even be about. Mm-hmm. But
we're going to expose ourselves for not, you know, all that knowledge we displayed on those past episodes. We didn't actually have that. We crammed for the test and then
it was all Wikipedia.
Yeah, it was all, we just read the Wikipedia. So now we're just, this is a reflection of what's actually in our brains, yeah, which is just nothing.
Although there is one band that I did want to talk about.
Dive.
I think this would be obvious. Depeche Mode.
Woo.
Because we did a tour with them somewhat recently. I don't know when this episode will come out, but that was the last tour that we did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like, I knew the hits, but I didn't know much about them or like their music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is true for you guys too, but now I'm like such a big fan. And it's like each one of their albums has like something different to offer. And they have like eras, you know, from like the 80s and then the 90s and then the 2000s. And even now their newest record's really good.
Well, they're just such an exciting band to discover. Like, I wish I could discover them again. Like, it's kind of like if somebody was like, I've never heard of like The Beatles or The Cure or whatever, you would be like, oh my God, you have such a beautiful journey ahead of you. You know, and if somebody's like I asked my friend before the tour, like, what's an album I should listen to? And he's like, listen to the entire discography in order.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, what? And I completely get that. And that's like what I would say to somebody who like wanted to get into The Cure or something, like, man, there's so much for you to uncover. But yeah, similarly, like we got, you know, we like confirmed the tour and somebody's like, oh, Depeche Mode, like I haven't heard of them. What's a song? And I was like, you know, like dun 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 or something.
Wait, which one was that?
Just Can't Get Enough.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's like their first hit single, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, the journey, I think that we all... It was like when we did the tour with Ariel Pink, it was like we... I feel like we've talked about this a bunch, but we would, like, play the show, watch Ariel play, get in the van, and, like, listen to Ariel records, mm-hmm. and then, like, talk about the songs and, like, all the stuff, and that was, like, my experience on the Depeche Mode tours. Like, we'd see all this like machinery happening backstage, watch their show, and then like watch documentaries about them and mm-hmm. listen to the songs and make playlists of songs and talk about the different records and the songs. And it was like like as immersive a music discovery experience as you can have.
And the shows were sick. They're so good live.
Yeah, they're such a live band. Like, their kind of like breakthrough moment was the Rose Bowl show right here in Pasadena.
They did that's a live album, right?
It's a live album, and it was like a televised or like filmed concert that was like, you know, I guess a clusterfuck going into it, and then it just like happened to be like one of the greatest concerts of all time. And I feel like that like cemented their legacy, and it was like a live moment, which for largely like electronic music is not the norm, you know.
Yeah.
What was your experience, Colin, of the...
I mean, it was just like, that's like the coolest way to get into a band.
Yeah.
It's like you're on an arena tour with them. And like, I mean, I echo everything you guys said about them just being like amazing. But the coolest thing, I think, and the thing that I said to a lot of people who were like, how was the tour, is like, I think a lot of people would assume that it's like a legacy tour or something, but they're still just a contemporary band. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the feeling playing with them, was that they approach it the same way they always have. And the show is just like, oh, we're going on tour rather than like, let's go out and like, you know, play our greatest hits, which they're also doing, which is cool. But yeah, it was just so fun to see kind of like, to get a picture of a band with like legitimate longevity that isn't just like, you know, kind of mining their popularity from a different era.
Yeah. It was also just like fun and interesting opening for such a huge band. Like we had more time than we usually do, cause like we barely got a sound check and all that stuff. Yeah. So we 100%ed Donkey Kong 1 and 2, Donkey Kong Country.
And 3.
And right. I don't know if we 100%ed 3, but we beat all three of them. Yeah.
Yeah. We had a Super Nintendo, a legit Super Nintendo with an emulation cartridge with like all the games that were made for the system for the most part, I think. So and maybe some Japanese versions or something.
I had those but too. Yeah. It was really like impressive. And, you know, all the shows were at these like arenas, you know, obviously a lot of things happen in arenas. You know, there would be like a basketball game the next day or a hockey game that, you know, so like we were in these locker rooms and I guess like the coach or something needs like a screen to see the game.
There's always a TV.
There's always a TV like mounted on the wall, but it's really hard to like access the HDMI port or like figure out like how to plug it into the wall and plug it in. So we had these like complex networks of cables and would like shine our flashlight behind the TV and like kind of try to fish for the HDMI cable. And there's my like most clear memory of like the absurdity of the situation with the Super Nintendo was like there was the lockers and then there's the TV above it. We had the Super Nintendo like across the room and there was cables plugged into cables just like strung across the room. And you could only see the TV if you stood on a table. And that was the day that Dave Gann from Depeche Mode decided to come and say hi to us. And yeah. He walked in the room and was just like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny experience playing those shows because he came in and he was like, what? You know, I was actually in catering, so I missed that time. But I can, from what you guys said, he's like, what's going on? Like looking around, like what's going on here? But yeah. It's like we got placed in that room.
Right.
It wasn't our choice to be living in those circumstances.
In an actual locker room.
And that was so, one of the better ones.
It was one of the better ones.
Yeah, like really? At least in the middle. Because like, remember MSG? We were in like a...
Oh, yeah.
Like the press room, like in all these empty cubicles.
Oh, yeah, but at least, you know, MSG, that was the only green room on that tour with a window.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really enjoyed that.
Yeah,
so
really
at the very
cool.
least, like, yeah, because that was when we had, like, friends and family over, and there was something pleasant about, like, oh, it's like the sun hasn't set yet.
Yeah.
Whereas normally you would, like, enter the complex in the parking lot and time would just disappear. It's very weird, like, the bizarre, like, whiplash sensation you would get from showing up to the venue being like, wow, I can't believe we're playing, like, Barclays Center or something, having this surreal experience. You go in, and then it's like, everything is just kind of the same. You're in a similar yeah. type of like decrepit, like umpire locker room that kind of smells like just like bodies.
Like, yeah. And like medicine or something.
Medicine, yeah. And then, but then, you know, set time comes and we all get up and we go stand by the stage and there's so many people in there. And then you go on stage and you play and we were like literally rock stars. It wasn't like, you know, sometimes family will be like, oh, you guys are like rock stars because you like are playing in Europe or something. And like, yeah, that is cool. But you always have this sense of like what is beyond or like a bigger venue.
Mm-hmm.
But then we would play in an arena to like 12,000 people. And in my mind, I'm like, well, this is actually it.
Mm-hmm.
We are kind of rock stars right now. You'd get such a high from playing. The shows were great. And then you would walk off stage and go back into the room where the Super Nintendo is. And it's just this like crazy, yeah, like whiplash of like this insane adrenaline and then just the completely normal kind of sensation of like, okay, I guess we sit on the couch.
Yeah,
now,
you're just like a cog in the machine.
Yeah.
And there's so many staff and so many people. But there is like this kind of comfort to the, like I remember before the tour, I was nervous and I talked to Dustin from Beach Fossils who had just done that tour with Post Malone.
Mm.
And I was like, what's it like playing in front of a lot of people? And he was like, well, once you're in the venue, it's like, they're all the same. So you just are like, there's a, you know, there's a comfort in like having done the exact same thing before. And so like it was nice to just, you know, it's a support tour. We're there to support.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are just like in a way a cog in the Depeche Mode machine. And yeah, like it was very unceremonious backstage, you know, but there was something kind of beautiful about it.
Yeah, we were just kind of part of the crew.
Yeah, it felt like work, but in a way, like sometimes you talk to people and they're like, oh, it's so cool you get to go on tour. It's like, yeah, but you know, it's a job too. It's like work. And usually there's a tinge of it, that being like a negative thing. But on the arena tour, it felt like very like fulfilling because it's like we know our job. Mm-hmm. It's to support. And like we were just part of like, how many people were on that crew? Like
100?
Something crazy, like 13 semi trucks and 5 buses or something, and the band flies separate and all that. And yeah, you just show up and everyone's eating in the same room. You play the show and there's like a reverence about the show where like the crew is like acknowledging, it's like, okay, you're part of the talent. But then when you walk off stage, it's like, okay, now you're just another one of us. Mm-hmm. But it was like a positive thing. It made me feel like really like vital or something. And I don't know. That being like work, that's kind of the best you could hope for.
Yeah, like the hallways and like catering and stuff was like the great equalizer because we don't know what people's roles necessarily were. So you could be like Depeche Mode's manager and you're, you know, like we didn't know who everybody was at first and they don't know who we are. We're just, you know, in catering. And
yeah, I was being so nice to every British person I met just in case Depeche Mode.
And like a cool thing about them is like the loyalty that they display in like their crew is kind of these like old, wizened, like British people who have definitely been with them for a long time. It was really cool to see that the reason the machine worked so well is because like the roles are so clearly defined and they've been doing them for so long and they know how to interact with each other. It was like beautiful to watch it happen, you know, like. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I knew this, but like this, you know, you go to a show at MSG, there's the big speakers on the side. Like the band brings those.
Yeah. And the
like,
stage.
The
itself.
Literal stage they mm-hmm. bring, you know, and then there's people who set it up every day and break it down every day. The big screens and all the stuff. They just do that every day.
You show up to the venue and it's just a room, it's just an empty basketball court or whatever.
I mean, those places are crazy because they're all hockey arena, basketball court, concert space.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they're set up, I found out, is that it's the ice on the bottom. Which is always there frozen. And then there's the basketball court. And then there's an additional surface for the concert. And in order to make the kind of revolving door of events work, it's basically like there are people in there working at all times. So when we would leave every now and then, we would like watch the whole Depeche Mode show. And then we would leave like late after like merch was settled or something. And the buzz of activity in there, it's like almost there's like a day and night cycle of its own
mm-hmm.
where like there's all these like IATSE unionized workers coming in to like fly or take down the PA. And then there's a whole other set of workers who are then transforming it for the next event. And it's this constant process, which was...
And like hundreds of them too. Remember mm-hmm. in Dallas where they were all just chilling in the garage area as we were leaving?
Yeah, the local crew.
It was insane. It was like, I felt like I was at like a festival or something mm-hmm. in a garage.
That was one of my favorite, when I was going to ask this, like what are your most memorable moments or whatever, but that was one of my most memorable was that, I think it was Dallas where like we were leaving and you got the sense that there was like an entire subculture of people who work at that venue. They're all like riffing together and laughing and joking. And there was this atmosphere. It's like, wow, this is a world I didn't even know existed. And it seems so like rich. And all these people like are so excited about what they do, you know, even though it's like the kind of unseen part, like no one going to the show is really considering that aspect.
Did you ever see like it's one of the Matrix sequels? I can't remember which one, but like they show the underground society of humans that's still alive. That's what it felt like because mm-hmm. you are underground in mm-hmm. this weird, it feels like a cave. And then, yeah, it was just like hundreds of people who are like getting pumped for their day at work at like midnight.
Yeah, they're like gig workers. So they, you know, people would be showing up and be like, is this the right place? Like, who do I talk to? And then there's just a clothing rack of shirts that say like Depeche Mode Local Crew, which we were always so jealous of. And we may or may not have acquired a couple of those.
Yeah. It's cool too that all the people that worked at the arena, the people that worked for the band, and then the local crew would come in to do it. Like, everyone seemed stoked, and there was a sense that like everyone was being compensated fairly. Like, everyone seemed to be in like a positive, good mood. And like, you only get that from like this kind of like, Cole and I had a cigarette in the second show, I think, and we got to have a long conversation with Toby, who was the production manager. Depeche Mode, arguably the most hardworking person, or at least the one who just seemed to always be doing something.
Yeah, his days were like 18 hours every single day.
He managed every team.
Right. Also, the guy that would like be side stage with us before we went on, and he would give the cue for the lights to dim and us to go on. So he was like, he's probably the person that we like interacted with the most, maybe one of five or something. But he told Cole and I about like his ethos for how a tour like that should be run, and it's like equally valuing everyone. And that was kind of like, it felt like we got really embraced because it's not like we were just some random support, which I think on a lot of those tours you kind of get the short end of the stick or whatever. And with this, it was like there was this sense that like Toby and everyone working there was like looked at us and they were like, you guys need to be happy for the show to be good. And then that kind of got applied to everyone. Like, everyone needs to be doing okay and feeling good in order for the Depeche Mode show to be a success, rather than it just being all focused on like Dave and Martin and everyone, like, you know, getting stoked.
Yeah, it's cool to feel like our role was, in their eyes, like essential.
And when we played in Orlando, they took the entire crew of whoever wanted to Disney World.
Oh my God, yeah.
Not us, but like the Depeche Mode crew. So like when we played that show, we were like, everyone seemed in a good mood. And we're like, what's up? And they're like, oh, we went to Disney yesterday. It was so fun.
And like remember all the local staff, like the people who worked at the venue were so, you know, the people who are like, let me see your credentials or whatever, walking through the hallway were like, my first takeaway was like, this must be a good job because these people are so nice and like happy to be at work.
Unless you vaped inside.
Bailey made a good point yesterday when we were filming the music video. He was vaping and the guy was like, you can't vape in here. And there was like five fog machines going and it's like, those are vapes.
You know,
they're just nicotine free vapes.
I felt like such a dick when I said that though. I really regretted saying it. I tried to say it in a nice way. Like, oh my bad. I just assume when the giant vape machine is going, I'm allowed to use my little one. Whatever.
Bailey, what's your memory or takeaway experience from Depeche Mode?
Well, I didn't do what y'all did. I didn't deep dive into them. Lately, I've been realizing that it's like a personality defect of mine or a character flaw. That like whenever
everybody being a Depeche Mode fan. That's true.
Just when everybody around me is like getting into something, I can't. It's this like irrational contrarian mindset that I've been like trying to change in the last few months. But I was hearing you guys talk about it and I was like, oh, that does sound pretty cool. And Cole recommended one of the records and I was like, yes, this is definitely something I would like.
Yeah, I like spent like 2 days thinking about like, okay, of these records, what is the perfect record to recommend Bailey? I knew it would be like one of the like 2000s, late 90s, like post Nine Inch Nails type, more industrial, kind of like darker,
is that
heavier.
Ultra? Is that one of them?
Ultra is
one
of them.
One.
It's kind of everything after Songs of Faith and Devotion, which is that the one I think I maybe recommended Ultra.
I do not recall.
Yeah, but I really like put a lot of thought because I wanted you to like be a part of the thing that we were experiencing.
Yeah.
Well, but like, just the time, like the tour, like what's your memories and shit?
I usually every show I'll make a point to like be mindful and like in the moment and just look around and being like, whoa, this is what I'm doing right now. And it, those moments on this tour were so much bigger, I guess, mm-hmm. like, and left a really big impact on me, I think, where like if I close my eyes and picture the tour, I'm picturing those moments. And it was usually during Take Your Time, because Corey, our lighting guy, would do these like kind of spinning lights on the crowd. So there was just like, it was a really special moment every night. And so that's when I picture the tour, that's what I picture, is like those moments of just feeling like so fortunate. And
yeah, it definitely felt lucky the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. And just being like, constantly reminding myself that yes, I have won the lottery. Like, this, like it's easy to forget and to focus on the hard things of tour, because tour is really hard, you know, even when it's an arena tour.
Because mm-hmm. we were still in a van.
Like, yeah, yeah,
we were doing, yeah. We were on a private jet.
Yeah, and so you know, you're tired and cold and sick and hungry all the time. But like just being able to play the arenas, because one of my favorite things to do after we play is just walk around the neighborhood where the arena is or where the venue is. But with the arenas, you can't really do that. And so I'd end up just walking around the parking lots of Depeche Mode concerts. And I'd usually be out there, unless we left early, I'd be out there when the show gets out. And so I'd be like walking against the stream of like, you know, thousands of people leaving the building. And we weren't on the Jumbotron, so nobody knew it was me. And just sort of like hearing people talking about the show, and every once in a while somebody mentions us and stuff like that. That was really cool. And that's something that I've never had at any other show before. And also just having more time to walk around. I saw some cool shit. I saw the tree that owns itself. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was rad.
We all took a field trip to, is it Dealey?
Dealey.
Oh, yeah, 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 exactly. Going to Dealey Plaza, stuff like that. Or I went to the site of the Boston Massacre and spent like an hour just kind of standing there, soaking it in and stuff.
Yeah, that I feel like that speaks to this ability that you have that I witness it, you know, and I feel like it's something that I don't do, which is to like kind of like put yourself in the moment, like on the spot, you know, mm-hmm. like a small example is like, okay, every time Bailey walks onto an airplane, he like touches the side of the plane and it feels like this really like loaded moment. Like when I see you do it, mm-hmm. I can feel the like profound experience yeah. you're having, where it's like, I'm trusting this thing with my life. I'm going to go inside it. All the destinations this plane has gone,
yeah,
you're
exactly.
absorbing it all right there in your hand. That, the energy, you know, that's like, you know, that's one example or whatever. But I watched it happen a bunch on this tour, which would kind of like put me in the moment. Mm-hmm. There was one where we were in, was it like Cleveland or something? Or I don't know where it was. We were in the locker room where, where the Cavaliers or something had won, and like Bailey pulled up on YouTube a video of the team like celebrating in this like literal spot where we were standing, and we looked in the background, you could see the things, and I feel like those were some moments I like watched you have, or like MSG obviously, or like touching the ground, and like I fucking watched like this happen here when
that's my favorite part about all of that. And yeah, the locker rooms, I forgot about that. Standing in the showers of the locker room was so cool. I took a shower every night because it's like LeBron James showered
here
when he won the championship, or like, you know, and like the urinals are like 2 feet higher than normal ones and stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
and they all are marked up from people pissing in their skates with like the hockey players with their skates on like stand in front of the urinal, so there's just these like dug out like skate holes.
Yeah, stuff like that I really enjoy.
I believe that this podcast will be coming out probably after, but around the time of the new single, Brown Paper Bag. We could talk about what that song kind of like reminds us of musically, or just any thoughts on that song, if anybody has any.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking like, because there was a prompt of like what songs inspired it or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I made like a playlist that kind of captures.
Link in bio.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah. It's an interesting playlist. It's hard. It's funny because I feel like at least the way I think all of our minds work with music, but especially mine, is I'll think of a musical concept and want to emulate it. And if I successfully do it, I'll go listen to the reference and it's not actually that similar. Like mm-hmm. I have a weird idea of, you know, we talked about like last record, we like listened to a lot of MBV and there was this feeling that like the vocals had reverb on them. And then when you go listen to the music, they're like completely dry.
Yeah.
So that happened a lot, but like there's this one song I forgot about, that Pure X song, Middle America.
Damn, I love that band.
Yeah, this band is so underrated. I mean, I kind of, not to throw shade or whatever, but I understand why they're not bigger, because it's like, it's very casual music. But
and kind of like lo-fi.
A little lo-fi. I mean, this one album is like well produced and cool sounding, but it's actually, I don't know if you guys remember when I made like the template, the sludge template or whatever. It was in response to this song.
Yeah, I used that template on every single demo.
Yeah, it found its
like
way
a logic
in.
Template when you you open it and all the sounds are already dialed in, and so you don't have to do the like work.
Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, in case you've never used Logic Pro before, but
facts and logic.
Yeah, just this song of like this song had like kind of like sludgy esque guitars, but it's really poppy and like emotional sounding. And then simple drums, simple bass, and the vocals just like float above. And I remember when Brown Paper Bag started to take shape, I was like, yes. Like I did the thing. Mm-hmm. And then, but then you listen to it and it's like, oh, it doesn't really sound anything like that.
That's a really great way to write a song, is to try to basically cover a song, but from memory. Mm-hmm. Like don't like do a super specific reference, like here's I'm gonna look up the tabs, but just like imagine the song and then try to remake it on your own, and it usually ends up a completely different thing but still a cool song.
I give that advice to people a lot, like, you know, no matter what, and I feel like I say it all the time just like in conversation or something, but like anything you make, it's gonna sound like you. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes so much work to like emulate something exactly,
yeah,
that like it's gonna sound like you, so just like start from there. Mm-hmm. You know,
and sometimes it's impossible because like, you know, how many times have you listened to a song and you're like, I love that guitar part, and then you find out it's a keyboard or like whatever, you know, like you it's yeah extremely difficult to like do a one-to-one remake of a song.
What's that song called, Colin?
Middle America.
All right. I'm gonna give a little listen to
yeah. Just has like it does the magic trick of it. It's like it is sludgy, but it's so easy to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And like there's these like chunky chords that just like sit underneath the vocals. And it also has like the kind of like country tinge that I think Brown Paper Bag has in a weird way.
Yeah, the harmonic part, like bing bing boing, is like very country, like slide.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like call and response thing. I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, me neither.
I know, it's funny too. I have this like hope for that song because I think, like, similar to that shoegaze article, I've seen a couple articles about like alt country being like a thing now too. Mm-hmm. Even like that Wednesday record kind of traffics that feeling, but I feel like Brown Paper Bag is, it just nods to it. It's not like a genre song as much. And I think too, if you kind of like on the playlist, there's also like When the Sun Hits, the slow dive song, which is funny because like the slow dive section, as it's referred to in Brown Paper Bag, has this huge guitar line, but there isn't really a slow dive song that does that. A lot of times they have like synths layered in. It's way more ethereal, but it'll just be the idea of something like floating above the instrumental or something. Another song on the playlist is Sex and Candy, that Marcy Playground song.
Haven't heard,
which every time I mention
forever.
This, Cole, you laugh. Yeah. But like if you listen to it, there are really specific moments in it where it's like, oh, there it is. Like even the original demo, I said, yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of again or whatever. Mm-hmm. And like it is like in the moment, that song was somehow like in my brain coming out of my mouth. You know, there's like a character maybe associated with like the alt thing you're talking about.
Hanging around downtown by myself, and I had so much time to sit down and think about myself, and then there she was, like double cherry pie. Yet there she was, like disco superfly. I smell sex and candy here. Who's that lounging in my chair? Who's that casting devious stares in my direction? Mama, this surely is a dream. Yeah. Yeah, mama, this surely.
The kind of like, because it, we talked about it being kind of slacker, as like the built to spill come down section, which also like I tried to find the built to spill song that part actually sounds like, and it doesn't really exist. Which I think we always do really, and even in the end, like the, what is it, what's the Loveless song that we jacked for the synth line? Is that not Coming Alone? I Only Said.
Well, and it wasn't like on purpose.
Right, it happened.
Like Cole, I remember you doing that part on the keyboard, and I was like, we can't do that because MBV, but we just did it anyway.
Well, it's funny how, you know, like referring to that section as the slow dive part, referring to that other section as the built to spill part, we like shorthand these, you know, like Deceiver, there was like the Deaf Heaven part in Acheron, which doesn't really sound like Deaf Heaven, or like, but we just, yeah, you kind of like, we have like a language for speaking with each other that is like, you shorthand an idea in a way that like, it's an approximation, like any shorthand, I guess. But like, yeah, I remember, well, okay, so Brown Paper Bag started with a Colin demo, and like, every song was kind of like workshopped, and we were working at Colin's house for a while, and he has the, what's that thing called? The CZ1000. It has like a pitch bend wheel. Yeah. And I remember doing the MBV part, and like, I had absolutely no idea that was the MBV line. Like, just some things are just like implanted in your brain, mm-hmm. and you have no clue. Like the guitar part on Human, our first record, is literally a guitar line from a Wild Nothing song that I guess I had been listening to, but it just like, it's just like in your brain. Like a long time ago, that band Girls, I was like a huge fan. I'd never met them, and they had this song called Morning Light, and it was like, I saw them standing like backstage at a festival, and I was like, ooh, I want to talk to them. Like, I'm going to talk about the song Morning Light. And I was like, it's so cool how you took the riff from Sonic Youth's song Moat and then rewrote it. And they were like, what? They'd never listened to Sonic Youth, I guess, and didn't know it was the exact same riff. And some things, they just like enter your consciousness somehow and then implant mm-hmm. in there mm-hmm. and then are expressed like in ways you can't really understand. But anyway, or we just fucking ripped it off, who cares, you know?
I mean, I think there's a cool thing that happens where like you, it's smart. I remember when Mac took that keyboard line from that obscure Japanese artist, the
Chamber of Reflection one.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. And initially people were like, hey, you can't do that, but like Mac has like an evolved take. And I think we do too, that like you're taking stuff even when you're unintentionally doing it. Mm-hmm. So if you just accept that, and as long as you don't rely on it too much, you can also just take things intentionally, because it, whether or not it's intentional or unintentional, the thing is like whether or not the listener has like a new experience with that idea or feeling yeah. at the end.
It's like oral tradition. You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
It's
totally.
Like there's something. And like it's the same conversation that happened around like sampling or mm-hmm. whatever, or like that Neil Young line on Tonight's the Night where he's talking, that song Borrowed Tune, where he's talking, where he's like, this melody I borrowed from the Rolling Stones, and like yeah, I like it's its own thing. Yeah. It's not just like a, you know, one for one.
And it can be a sign of respect too. Like in hip hop, they do it with lyrics a lot. Where I'll mm-hmm. be listening to like Eric B and Rakim, which I don't usually do, and realize that there's a Nas lyric that is like a tribute. You know, he's not just like barring and hoping nobody notices. He's yeah. doing it so fans of Rakim will respect him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's like an Easter egg.
Mm-hmm.
It's an Easter egg, and I think it does like a really special thing where it like people who aren't even like music scholars or musicians have like a real deep understanding of music based on what they've heard. And so if you allude to something, their experience of the song changes. And the only time it really sucks is when either there isn't enough of a variety of those elements synthesizing mm-hmm. or someone's just straight up ripping something.
Which can, as we've said, can happen accidentally too. Sometimes you'll like write a straight up like verse and chorus of a song and be like, man, I've done it. I'm a fucking genius. And then you're like, oh, that's literally already a song.
Yeah. I also think it gives music context. I think people have a hard time like talking about music because a lot of times it's like presented without context, especially now in like the streaming era or whatever, mm-hmm. where you can just kind of like, you know, get a piece of everything and it like exists without context. And so you kind of are like forced to draw these like through lines, or just in interviews, like straight up say, this is a influence. And like, cause it, people don't want to like necessarily draw those, parallels or whatever, you know? But I do it all the time and I sometimes feel bad. People like play me a song and I'm like, sounds like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like,
ugh. But it's not a, yeah, it's not a bad thing, especially if it's an artist that you respect. You're like, damn, you did it. You like got the essence of this other really good thing.
Yeah, it's just context.
Yeah.
Also for us, I think that like we ultimately reference ourselves the most. And
on this
we
record.
Have a sound, and like that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make it sound like Dive. So if we're pulling in these other references, they have to be like held up against, you know, like the kind of like core of the song. Like, even the I put Sometime
By Dive
on the playlist because like it, the keyboard intro of Brown Pair Beg is like exactly an homage to Ocean songs that start with a keyboard loop and then go away. Like, I always thought that was such a cool thing about that record. And like, there are a bunch of things on the whole Frog record, but especially this song, that are like exact references to ourselves, mm-hmm. which I feel like as long as you're like focusing on that enough, then you're like in the clear.
We could sue ourselves.
That's
good idea. I remember though, when we were writing kind of like in the earlier phases of the, and this was at Colin's house, when I was like, Cole, like, how do you write a dive song? And you're like, oh, like what I usually do is like detune one of the strings and keep it open and then just write a melody on the other string and do a, and so I was like, awesome. And so then I tried to write like 10 dive songs in a row, but that was like the old dive paradigm.
I guess I didn't think that was how I wrote songs 10 years ago.
Yeah. And then so like all of those demos, it was kind of like, no, it sounds too much like, you know, Ocean or whatever. Like, fuck.
They were cool though. Yeah. I remember those. They were really like, cause Ben, your demos all like you wrote them in a little closet.
Yeah.
And they felt like it, you know, they're like really like paranoid and claustrophobic
really cool,
sounding.
Like, yeah. Paranoid, claustrophobic, underwater
closet core
vibe.
Yeah, I think too. I the Brown Paper Bag really was like an exact response to the Reflected demo, because I think the Reflected demo, in my mind at least, was the first proper demo for the record, where it's like we were doing all different kinds of stuff, and then that one came around and it felt like this balance of the old dive and Deceiver, which was kind of like a spoken and unspoken intention, was to make a record that was like kind of doing everything that we did rather than like a genre record or something. And yeah, so like, and if you listen to the original Reflected demo and then listen to the Brown Paper Bag demo, they are like similar tempos, similar like guitar ideas or whatever.
Yeah, the like sludgy slacker type thing. Should we talk about the like all the different idea, like all the different directions that we thought about going for the record until like that one crystallized? Because we had been sending demos back and forth for like a long time, you know, and like the different phases and the different ideas we had.
Yeah, what's one that comes to mind?
Well, there was a big Yaesu phase where I think every demo I had like Yaesu 1, Yaesu, well, one of them made the record, Yaesu Suspended, which was a Yaesu type sounding demo with a suspended chord in it,
which is now Fender on the Freeway,
the last track.
But it changed a lot.
Changed a lot
from the original demo. But yeah, at first it was like Yaesu.
A lot of Yaesu, there were a lot of duster sounding songs.
Yeah, that was a direction. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, I think I was like, what if duster was just tuned down to like C, like what if it was just like slower?
Those were cool too. I like
they are
a lot
cool.
Of those
they
demos.
Sound like a. They sound like a band in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. We did some of those in the practice space too, as a band. I think, like just the like slow, simple drums and like clean guitars.
Yeah, like detuned clean guitars. That we barked up that tree for a minute, and then as we started working more like, you know, like as they say, in the box, you know, Deceiver, we fleshed out the songs like as a band in a room with like amps and drums, and then started working like in the computer because it was, well, A, we were like, it was the pandemic, and B, that was just like the way that we could pass ideas back and forth like the most like efficiently, it seemed. So then it started kind of becoming this like headphones, like on the grid, like I don't even know how you'd describe
computer
it.
Computer album.
Computer album. Yeah.
And even in the computer zone, I feel like there was kind of two different directions where we used 70s kit a lot.
70s kit is amazing. Yeah. They got rid of it.
Well, you can, it's still
Legacy.
Yeah, Legacy.
Oh.
But it has like a gothy kind of feeling. And so I feel like some of the demos went that way. And then the other one was when we were tired of using 70s kit, we would use break beats. And so there's this like trip hop direction too, that like the computer branched between like goth and like trip hop.
Mm-hmm. But it's cool now to think about how all of that stuff did find its way into the album. It's just like, you might have to like think about where it came from. But like, I'm trying to think of one of the Duster songs, there must be a part that made it into the record.
Not sure. Probably.
Because there was also like, Ben, you were writing like the ocean-y, like Aziz Azar stuff. Mm-hmm. I was also doing it. And you also did that because Raining on Your Pillow is one of the like OG dive sound demos. Because
it
that
has
process.
A Bailey part, which is just a repeating.
Like a loop.
Yeah, guitar loop.
And the goth sound.
Mm-hmm.
It has like that kind of.
And the kind of chorus-y guitar.
Yeah.
It's also like funny how the dive podcast had like an influence on the record, because every time we would, you know, we'd picked records specifically that were like important to like what we felt, you know, like the band was. And every time we would do the podcast, we would like make a song for it. Mm. And then we would always say like, we should make a song like that.
Yeah.
We should make a song like this band, especially like the Cure one, which then we did try to make, what's the In Your Room, right?
Yeah.
We tried to do that song like 100 times. And then like it kept happening with different bands on that we would like do in the podcast. Like, we should do something kind of like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, like the lead line on Brown Paper Bag and House Jam, which is now Soulnet, I think, if I remember correctly, it was like basically those happened because of the Slow Dive jam that we did. Mm-hmm. Because I played guitar in that jam. And I was like, I can't, you know, I can play guitar, but like, I'm not as adept. So I was like, okay, I can do this thing. And I detuned one of the strings. So it had the two, it's like that style of just one note hanging over.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like without that jam, like probably wouldn't have done it mm-hmm. on another song. People who listen to the podcast were like, oh, I hope that song becomes something.
Yeah.
And maybe they would, you know, be bummed. They're like, oh, it's not on the album, but it like kind of is. Like, all of those ideas did find a way to show up.
The one that hung over from the Sonic Youth one, which is like an unfortunate one, which is that every song on the record is in a different guitar tuning.
Yeah.
It's going to be a fucking...
Well, that's why we have Danny now.
Similar problem on Deceiver too, though, right? Live tunings.
Deceiver's in like 2 tunings.
I have 4 on Deceiver.
Oh, man.
And then there's the baritone.
Yeah,
guitar.
The baritone. This one is just like... Some of them are so fucked up. Like the Brown Paper Bag tuning.
Mm-hmm.
I think your guitar, when you made it, only had like 4 or 5 strings. And there's harmonics in it, which means you can't, like,
right.
You can't change the way you tune it because it's like dependent on the thing. So the tuning is like out of control.
There was also a period of time when we were working at Colin's house when his guitar was just in like the most fucked up tuning, but we would just pick it up and start playing it. So it would just be in that tuning, and then we'd be like, and then change one string, and it would just get like even more incomprehensible.
Yeah. And we would never make a note of what the tuning was. Cause like we were moving so quickly in a cool way. It was like very organic. It's like, oh, there's a part. Okay. Who else wants to try a new part? And we were just like layering things. So there's never like, I can't remember. I mean, there were moments where it was like, oh, this part is amazing, and we were all stoked, but there was never a moment where it was like, this is the final guitar part.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
So there was never a need
for
us to be like, we should probably take write a video down. Of this. Or yeah.
But then when we were actually recording, Bailey took like extremely extensive notes.
Mm, true.
Yeah, and rehearsing. You know, like, we didn't, unfortunately, we're not like, we couldn't just walk in the studio and play the record, you know? We had to like...
Learn the songs.
Learn it and practice.
The other cool thing, but I think we'll end up talking a lot about with all the different songs if we keep, like, you know, diving into them on the pod, is that, like, the entire process, like, we went through all these different phases of, like, Yesu demos, Duster demos, all that. But also the songs individually also went through bunches of iterations. And even though, like, some of them, like... The kind of initial demo was like maintained. Like Brown Paper Bag didn't get really fully written until like much later on, when like Bailey came up with the bridge chords, and then Cole, you wanted to change like the chords underneath the slow dive part. And it's cool that like the songs got fleshed out over time in a very patient way. And I feel like that's just good to, like, in keep, like, in talking about how, like, scattershot the references are, also the songs benefited from, like, multiple different approaches, like In My Room, in Joshua Tree, live when, or not live, but when we were rehearsing as a band, and then also in the studio. I felt like with each kind of different, like, moment that we were, like, reapproaching the song, it kind of grew naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of them finished the way that they started. They all changed. And some of them, like maybe the second or third iteration, ended up being the one that stuck, but none of them was the first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like, sending, you know, we would have a song, we're like, this is cool, it needs, like, something. Or one person would think, like, it needs something. And then, like, we would go home and, like, write a completely new part and, like, send it to the group text. And it would, like, sometimes be cool, sometimes not. It was like this, like, you just pick a random song. And then Ben was kind of like the dumpster diver of like demos, where you would, like, salvage these scraps into something. But it was like, there was something organic about it, where you'd just be, like, thinking about a song and you'd be like, I'm going to try, like, a thing on
here. Or I would just mute everything but the bass, or, like, just loop, like, one little guitar part or something, and try to write an entire new song around that.
That was cool, too, because, like, yeah, there were phases, and then I was saying earlier that, like, they found their way into the album. But, like, directly speaking, like, a couple of the songs that you reworked, like Cole was saying, they were from, like, really early on. Mm-hmm. Like, Raining and Everyone Out were, like, early, early demos, like, from around the Duster time, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's cool that, like, even though we kind of moved on from, like, a mood or something, we were able to then later, with, like, better context for what the album was starting to, like, feel like, to, like, redo it in a way that felt purposeful.
Well, it's crazy because, like, we had planned to talk about even more stuff, but we ended up talking for a really long time already.
Yeah.
That's good. I want to research more.
Yeah, it seems like that seems like a good sign that we could just, like, talk all day.
In the spirit of looking forward or whatever, like, the pod coming back, it does feel, like, very symbolic of, like, yeah, the album cycle starting, but also just, like, so much excitement about the, like, next chapter of the band or whatever. And for people listening, like, it's so cool that you're interested enough to go the extra mile to listen to this. It's really sick.
True.
Good luck and God bless.
Goodbye.
The end.